Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Sitting up there, jacked with Pepsi.
I'm there for the pack out. You just got to pack me in.
Committed to the bow early on. Like, I loved getting close and putting up.
You cover a range of stuff on here too, right? Like,
we call this the THP World Headquarters.
You know, my grandpa Roy Weatherby.
I came into like that golden little pocket where there was like four or five different bowls. Just
you're Canadian. We're doing a Canadian podcast.
My name's Douglas Oates.
I'm Robbie Denning. Roy Campbell.
I got default red waypoint icon tattooed on my shoulder. I'm like, okay, I'm good with that. Looks like we got somebody else trying to join us here, but
looks really old. I didn't Senior's Day.
So, you know, I cringe when guys tell me that. Oh, I'm a, you know, I'm an OnX guy. I only use OnX, or I'm a Go Hunt guy. And I live and die Go Hunt. I'm like, well, I like it too. Or I use Gaia, or I like you Canadian guys. I recommend, if you don't know about Gaia, you need to look at it very carefully. It's got a tremendous amount of Canadian tools. We've talked about that before on podcast, but it is a very valuable tool. Here in the West, and even for Canadians, I think, is from what I've seen with it. It's one of my favorite apps. But the key is multiple tools. And that's why, you know, I said Google Earth. Google Earth is still, to this day, is my number one hunt planning tool. I spend the most time in this course going through Google Earth and how to use it effectively and efficiently and how to apply it. Because it is still the number one. Now, the apps are getting better and better and better, guys. They're getting better all the time. More tools, more features, more things. But nobody has the image quality of Google Earth. Nobody has the historical imagery capabilities of Google Earth. Nobody has the route profile capabilities of Google Earth. Nobody has the view shed capabilities of Google Earth. They just don't. Now, maybe they will, and they don't have the 3D capabilities of Google Earth. Now, they have 3D, and it's pretty good, but it's not as good as Google Earth. So I know I sound like a broken record, but Google Earth, guys, is no good to you in the field. If you're not doing your work now in February, mm-hmm. like we're talking about with this podcast, that tool is useless to you in September. This is a tool that has to be used and applied and vetted right now. Not right now, but before the hunt, right? Before the hunt. So when I talk about zones of pressure, I spend an enormous amount of time looking at vehicle accesses, what roads are open, what roads are closed, and what roads are seasonal. And I do not rely on one tool. I look at my hunting apps. I look at my layers, my toolkits that I built in Google Earth, but then ultimately I go retrieve the, you guys might want to write this down. I retrieve the geotagged PDF files from the National Forest Service where I got the most recent motor vehicle closures, and I always lay them out side by side on my map, and I trace the roads to make sure that I'm not missing anything. One of my very, very best hunting areas that I've ever been to was a road that was seasonally closed. It closed on September the 6th, which in Montana, you never hear of a road closing in the after the first week of elk season. It rarely happens, right? It's either they're open or they're not, right? They're not, they don't close in the middle of the season. But this one did for some reason. All the apps were wrong. Every app was wrong. Said the road was open, open, open. So I pulled up there. I found it. I pulled up there. There's an outfitter sitting there, young kid. He had some horses. I had my llamas. And there was a big ruckus. We got to talking. He goes, how'd you find this spot? I said, well, to be honest with you, I was a little worried. I said, he said this road closed last week. And he goes, yeah, it does. I'm like, well, that's why I'm here. I gave it a week. I figure after that road closes a week later, the elk might filter back in here because the terrain looks incredible. He says, well, yeah, it is. And he said, you're the first person I've ran into here before like this. I said, because everybody thinks this road's open. And I'm like, yeah. I said, how do they? And he says, they got a bolt and they have a big gate and everything, so you can't get around it. And sure enough, so we talked and he asked me where I was going. And we stayed away from each other, obviously. And I went in, there was hundreds of bulls bugling in this spot. Nice. And it was a spot that was the first weekend, I'm sure, got worn out with vehicle, with ATVs and everything else. Mm-hmm. But I stumbled on it, guys. I know that was a long-winded story, but I stumbled on it because I was going through that checklist of testing my motor vehicle accesses in this spot. I had totally discounted this spot, guys. This was like spot 7 until I found the error. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to move that up my list. And I ended up going there, and we ended up, and we were covered up in elk for a solid week. I mean, more elk. I hate to say this, there was almost too many elk because these bulls would bugle and they'd run towards another bugle. We couldn't call an elk. There was so many elk bugling. One, we couldn't. I'm 58 years old. My hearing is not what it used to be. I couldn't tell what direction these bastards were. Number one. Number two, they're bugling every direction and they're all going to each other and not coming to us. And we were basically trying to intercept bulls on the way to other bulls. And it was crazy. It was one of the craziest bugling fests I've ever been in. But the fun part about it was I found it with this technique. And anyway, that was long-winded, but I wanted to spend time on that because that is a very important module. It's long, it's detailed, and step by step, and it's not a waste of time. Trust me on this. Because the more you study the pressure, where it's coming from, and how it's navigating in your hunting area, the more the picture starts to make sense. The more you start to really wrap your mind around a hunt area. Real quick, I'll tell you another quick story. I love telling stories with the thing that applies to what I'm doing here. So I was in a spot. We hiked in 6 miles, which isn't that far. We took the llamas in. We take the llamas in. We ran into some elk. It looks good. We set up our camp. Everything's money. We go out in the morning. We're into elk. Called in an elk. We didn't get one. Didn't get him. I was hiking down the trail, and I see this older dude. I'm like, in jeans. He's wearing jeans, blue jeans, and it's rainy, and he's got cowboy boots on, slick bottom cowboy boots and jeans, and he's got a longbow. Nothing wrong with that setup, guys. Nothing wrong with that. But let's just put it this way. He didn't just give me the impression that he was the epitome of fitness, okay? And I go up to him. I'm like, how did you get in here? I didn't mean it disrespectfully. He goes, well, I just hiked in this morning. I'm like, what do you mean you hiked in this morning? In your jeans? Well, my truck's just parked right over there. I'm like, what do you mean over there? Dude, I missed a road. I studied this area and studied this area. And this was an obscure road, right? This was a local dude that knew about this road. Mm-hmm. But I did find it on the National Forest Motor Vehicle Use Map. But I didn't look at it. It was not on the hunt applications. It was not in there, but it was on there. And this local knew about it. And this dude was like a quarter mile from where we were. And I'm just like, okay, you know, and he was the only, he didn't mess up our hunting at all. There's no problem. But my point is the time you spend on this is never a waste of time. Mm-hmm. It's never a waste of time. So, okay.
It's actually funny that you say that, because the more I paid attention to that, the more intense the pressure, that actually helped my hunting, because I was able to narrow in. Because when you see that and you see the trails, and then in archery, if you're in there, if you go back in late season, you know where all that pressure is coming from. And like, I took my kid out, I knew exactly where those elk were going to be because the pressure was so intense. I could narrow in. I'm like, oh, they can only be in three different spots.
Yeah.
Because the pressure from private and from public is so intensified, the trail access is only limited. Like, oh, they got to be right there. And we went there opening morning, we got them a bull, we found 200 head. So it's just, it's so critical. This part was one of the things that just makes your hunts more efficient, even too.
Well, it's funny you said that, because I get a lot of questions from Washington, Oregon, guys that hunt areas, high pressure areas, right? Like, like what you're describing. They're like, Mark, I can't get away from hunters. It's impossible. Excuse me. This zone's of pressure doesn't apply to me. I said, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. It's more important for you.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, what do you mean? I said, guys, I know this is going to sound crazy, but it's easier to, and I'm not discounting you, Derek, on you. It's easier to find elk in higher pressure areas than it is in no pressure areas.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, well, oh, what are you talking about? I said, let me give you an example. So if you go into the wilderness, you hike into the middle of the, let's just call it the Bob Marshall. There's no elk there anyway, so let's just use that example. You go into the Bob Marshall wilderness, millions of acres. You got to find a place where these elk want to be, because there's no pressure. There's nobody there. There's no moving them around. You have to find the exact place that they want to be because of the food sources, the north slope, all the features. But if you take Derek's example, when you're looking at for places where people, the furthest, the most difficult, the whatever you want to look at, where people guaranteed you got a high chance of running into elk there, those are easier to identify than some pinpoint spot in the middle of a million acre wilderness, guys, sometimes. So zones of pressure is absolutely money for guys that hunt high pressure areas. Now for low pressure areas, it's not as important, because the elk can be anywhere. There's low pressure, but it's still important. And in my case, what's more important in the lower pressure areas is the best access spot, which is going to be the easiest way to get in, easiest way to get out, which is going to be the, you know, the best for my llamas, or the best for backpacking, or the best for this, the best for that. So when you look at zones of pressure, guys, remember, we're not only, the last thing I'll leave you with on this is, we're not only looking at motor vehicle use. Derek said something in his statement I want to point out. The trail pressure is critical in high pressure areas. So where the established, what I mean is the established trails, you know, meaning on the topo map, where the trails are. In a high pressure area, you want to avoid, you want to work around those as much or more than you're going to work around the roads. Because hunters, they're just creatures of habit, guys. Most, I should say all, 90% of guys are not going to be very far from that trail. And if you can figure out drainages and ways and routes and ridges that you can stay away from, even a quarter mile away sometimes, guys, half a mile away from those established trails is a really key part of my planning when I'm looking at a higher pressure area. So keep all that in mind, and that's all covered in the course. In that section, on that establishing zones of pressure section.
And I will say, going through the course, the videos are very well detailed. I know we can't play them on the feed here, but it's especially with like the Google Earth and zones of pressure, it's really awesome if you have even a second monitor where you can play it, stop it, maybe do a couple of application features that you're talking about or specifying, make a waypoint, change your perspective, and then play again, and then kind of follow along is pretty helpful too, I found.
Well, you said that's a great, you know, that's coming up.
We can play them. I'm just not going to play them, because I mean, you guys,
when you go back and edit this, you can put in some of the, you know, some of the videos.
Yeah, they're really well done.
Well, except for the talking head that you mentioned earlier. I'm getting rid of that. I'm getting rid of that. I can't handle it. Guys, I don't know. I've got this aversion to seeing myself on camera. I don't know. There's something about it. Like all my hunting videos that we do, I can't watch them hardly. And all the podcasts I do, I rarely listen to them myself. And I was at a I was at a bear hunting event one time and I was speaking, and after it was over, this whole family comes up to me. Like, they got like 97 kids, and it's this young wife and young husband. I'm like, man, you guys have been busy. You know, I mean, they got a lot of kids. And his wife comes up to me. She goes, I feel like I know you. I'm like, really? She goes, I listen to you every night when I'm laying in bed. I'm like, because my husband has had this course on for months. Head. I'm like, oh my. Just
that's awesome.
So so when you talked about the tools of the trade, when you talked about your dual monitors, guys, one of the things that I do in there, in that module, and that's coming up, we'll get to that one. It's coming up too, but I want to jump to it since you said something about it, was –
yeah, let's skip over right to that one, and we'll keep rolling through these.
Okay, I do recommend a dual monitor setup, guys. It's not very expensive. I would rather see you personally, if money is an object, which, you know, it is for most people, I'd rather see you buy a cheaper, much cheaper computer and two nicer monitors than a super nice computer and just use the laptop screen. Because remember, all of your hunt planning, it's all web-based stuff, mostly, mm-hmm. right? It's all internet-based, browser-based, except for Google Earth Pro. And Google Earth Pro is such an old application, it runs on anything, right? All the things we're talking about do not require high-end computer power. So I would recommend...
with technology now, you can Wi-Fi anything just to a regular TV. You can watch
it
through everything.
Guys, multiple screens. That's the other thing I'll say. Everybody's like, well, I want to get a 40 inch. I'm like, that's okay. But I'd rather see you with two 20 inches than one 40 inch. For the same reason that we just talked about, guys, there is a big value into having Go Hunt, Gaia open on one screen, Google Earth open on another screen, and going back, copying latitude, longitude, pasting it in, and going to and analyzing it, doing the three, then going back and dropping a pin. And there's a tremendous amount of value in dual monitor setups when it comes to e-scouting. So I have a four monitor system now, but I'm going to tell you, I'm embarrassed to say this, but before I switched to this four monitor setup, I had a six monitor setup before that. It was like, I was like, my e-scouting room was like NASA. It was like, I could put up every application that I have, but it was too much. It was more for show than it was for reality.
I'd get a headache looking at
but that. I am switching now to a bigger monitors, two. So I'm constantly tweaking this, guys. Now, I'm not recommending you do all this, but I am noticing the best monitor you can get for e-scouting right now is the curved monitors. Right, the new curved ones. Mm-hmm. Now, guys, they have come down in price. I would never have recommended that a year ago or even 2 years ago. They were cost prohibitive. I would never spend that much money on a curved monitor. But this is funny. I was just in Costco, and I saw the curved landscape monitors for under $200. I was like, holy cow, this is the you know what I'm talking about, right? On these curved monitors, you guys have seen them. They present the almost incredible 3D resolution. So, and just with the ease of your eyes and to absorbing the big picture, I really like those monitors. I don't have them yet. So I do not have the curved monitors yet, but I am thinking about it right now. So anyway, that was, we're in the weeds, but I get that question a lot, guys. If I'm going to do this, how do I do it? Mm-hmm. And that's what I recommend is spend more money on monitors than you're going to spend on the computer is the basic. Okay. So hunt parameters was next. And in that module, I'm going to spend very little time on that because we talked about zones of pressure. So this is mainly for newer hunters, guys. This is for guys. This module is really designed for guys that are new. When I say new, under 3 years, you know, 3 years of Western hunting. Because one of the biggest mistakes that Western hunters make is they get on Google Earth, they get on their hunt app, they start looking around, they're like, well, I'm going to go here, 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 and here. Well, then when they pull up to Trailhead A, they're like, holy shit, this is way bigger, way steeper, and way further than I thought it was, right? Mm-hmm. We've all been there. We've all driven up spots and like, oh, man, this is, this looks a lot more interesting than I thought. So, guys, it's real easy to hike around these mountains on Google Earth. But when the truck actually goes into park and you've got to pull that backpack out of the back and you got to make your way to that first camp, and that camp is 9 miles away, and you're really only capable of doing 4 miles away, you got a problem, right? You got a big problem. And
we did, just to cut you off there, this is that exact thing happened to me and a buddy. We're going into this area, and I'm going to say this the nice way, he's just out of shape. So we get there and we start looking at it, and he's like, he was intimidated right away. I was like, well, it won't be so bad. We'll just, you know, we'll zigzag up through and we'll make our way up, and we're in no rush. We got a third of the way up and he pulled the plug. He couldn't do it. So we had to come up with something for the other 3 days. And, you know, we had set our goals, and I had done a lot of ski scouting on that area, and I know it holds good mule deer. And it's just, you know, obviously we didn't see a single thing after that, because we, you know, we spent a lot of time in areas that we just weren't.
That you hadn't planned to be in, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Guys, and so that's such a good story. But unfortunately, that is so common and what happens with that story, Kevin, is unfortunately, a lot of people that happens to, that ends their Western hunting careers.
Yeah.
A lot of guys are like, I'm just not cut out for this. And it's not because they're not cut out. It's just because they did not have a plan. Guys, you can kill elk right by the freaking road. You do not have to be 20 miles in to kill an elk. Now, I like to go deep because I like to be no people, unpressured elk. I just like it. I'd rather hunt less elk in a remote backcountry just spot where I'm kind of by myself, then I'd rather hunt more elk by the road. And that's just me. That's a personal preference. That's got nothing to do with whether there's elk there or not. But a lot of it's how you put it.
That's why it comes. This is the time to get into these courses, because you start building a hunt plan, you start doing your e-scouting. And if it seems like it's an area where you feel is going to be very physically demanding, now you get in shape. You start adding that to your hunt plan.
Right. You know what you're facing.
August. Yeah, exactly.
So what a hunt parameter is, guys, it's a real simple concept, but it's something it's one of those things that's so simple and it's so often ignored. So in Google Earth and in CalTopo and in a few of the other applications, you can create a radius. So in Google Earth, for example, is where I use it the most. And the reason I do it in Google Earth the most is because where do I do most of my pre-hunt work? In Google Earth. So I'll go to Trailhead A. If I know that my limit is about 5 miles, okay, I really don't want to be looking at many areas outside of 5 miles with my backpack, right? Whatever it is. Well, I draw a 5 mile radius around that trailhead. And I just leave it on the screen. So when I'm starting to look and I'm starting to e-scout and I'm starting to break it down, guys, that circle gives me a reference to be that's my reality zone.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't mean I won't creep over the line and look. But how many times are you in Google Earth? And you guys are on there a lot, so it's going to be funny. You guys are going to smile when I say this, I bet. All of a sudden, you're looking and you look back and you're like, oh, shit, I'm 20 miles on the freaking trailhead here. I'm wasting my time dropping weight pins back here, right? And so I have found that little simple task of dropping that 5 mile radius around the trailhead keeps me grounded and keeps me focused on where I need to be focused. Mm-hmm. Because you can waste a lot of time e-scouting an area that you actually can't actually hunt. And don't forget, I know this is so stupid and it seems so simple, is don't forget that you got to hike in there, but you also got to bring an animal out.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're doing elk, guys, now, most guys, I mean, Kevin, it doesn't matter. He's that dude's a beast, so it doesn't matter. I mean, he just brings elk out one trip. But if you're going to hunt mule deer, your radius is probably going to be a little bigger than if you're going to hunt elk solo. Would everybody agree to that?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe your blue zone, your hunt parameter is blue for mule deer, and maybe it's red for elk, and you have dip once 5 miles, once 7 miles, whatever. So I know that sounds like a basic, simple tool, but it is such an effective application. And we talk about why you want to do it, how to do it, and kind of some considerations that you want to think about when you do it in that module. Okay.
I think you should also have a secondary circle, even though like your 5 miles, let's say, is your money. Like that's your extent. But Kevin and I have talked about it lots in the last couple of years here in BC, where it's so freaking hot for the first month and a half of elk season. Okay, that's nice that you can walk that far. Now have a realistic circle as to how far and how long it's going to take you to get that elk, depending on the terrain, when it's 25, 30 degrees Celsius. I don't care if you can walk another 5 miles back. Nobody cares if you lose that elk.
That's right. Yeah,
keep that in mind too. And how steep that terrain is, or how nasty it is.
Yeah, and like we've already talked about in the show, is that I lost a lot of my first elk I killed in September. A lot of the elk went, like the bottom part of it went bone sour, just because like that day it was 35 degrees Celsius. And I mean, I was trucking pretty fast back to get it out, but still, I mean, you have to work. Those animals are so hot, it's the middle of the rut. There's a lot going on. So yeah, that's setting these.
Well, there's a whole set of strategies that you can employ for meat care too, but you're right. So here's the other thing too, you know, like Kevin mentioned this before, his buddy was kind of over his head on this hunt, right? On the mule deer hunt, right? It was a little beyond his capability. So they had to make an adjustment. Do you remember when I said earlier that I like to have 5 hunt plans, right? And remember how I said one of them should be a radical change in elevation, right? Well, one of them also should be a base camp hunt, meaning from a vehicle, from a base camp. Because what if you get hurt? What if you twist your ankle? What if you get fatigued? What if you get altitude sickness? All kinds of things where you need to fall back to a little bit different than a backcountry back-end hunt. Well, why not have a pre-designed spot that you can hike from the road every day and hunt? That way you're ready to, like if you had that case and you're ready to implement it. You're ready to jump to it if you need to. Now, you know, most cases you're going to be fine on your back 5 miles in. But if it gets hot, you get injured, you get whatever situation causes you to resort to a base camp hunt. So when I set up my strategy of my hunt plan, I've got, like I said, 5 options. One of them is always a radical change in elevation for a lot of reasons that we don't need to get into it right now, not just snow. And the second one is I always have an option for a base camp hunt. Even though I'm a llama guy, I pack in, guys. I love to pack in, right? I love to go deep. But I always have a vehicle base camp option somewhere in my strategy. And that's right.